Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Many people remember one of the big educational ideas of the 20th century, Schoolhouse Rock.
It's great to learn,
because knowledge is power.
In the 1970s and 80s, it was an innovative way to use television to help kids learn. Barack Obama was about 12 when Schoolhouse Rock was showing on Saturday mornings, and now he has a big educational idea of his own.
In the 21st century, the best anti-poverty program around is a world-class education.
The president isn't talking about a new way to learn or a new way to fund schools or to test kids or even to train teachers. He's talking about a complete overhaul.
As your body grows bigger,
your mind must flower.
It's great to learn,
because knowledge is power.
Power in knowledge? On The Takeaway.
On your favorite Schoolhouse, Schoolhouse Rock.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, February 2nd, and The Takeaway is, you know, someone's going to have to give if they're going to overhaul the educational system, and who's going to give first?
Well, we're
going to
see how Barack Obama's educational plans are faring in the schoolhouse later on in the program, but let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. Haitian officials are considering a trial for those 10 Americans arrested while trying to take children out of Haiti without proper documents. The Haitian prime minister says the Americans knew they were breaking the law, especially since some of the children have surviving parents. An orphanage spokesman quotes one of the kids who was taken to his facility. The kid reportedly told him,
"I'm not an orphan. I do have my parents. I thought I'm going to a boarding school or to a summer camp. We don't know it exactly, to the Dominican Republic."
No charges have been filed, but Haitian officials say prosecution is needed to help deter child trafficking.
This comes as the U.S. military says it'll now fly injured earthquake survivors to several states to avoid overloading Florida. That's treated an overwhelming majority of victims so far. For more on that, we're joined by Dr. Mark McKenney, medical director at Ryder Trauma Center and chief of surgery at the University of Miami Hospital. Good morning, doctor.
Good morning, Celeste.
What kinds of injuries are the people coming into the hospital? What are you treating them for?
Generally, after a catastrophe like this, we have two types of injuries, severe internal injuries and severe external injuries. All the patients with severe internal injuries died the first night because there was no one there to help, and we're seeing the severe external injuries like extremity fractures and gangrene.
And burn, I assume also some burns and crushing injuries as well. How long does someone generally have to stay in the hospital, a number of weeks?
Yeah, we have a model that estimates they'll be in the hospital for 10 days to 2 weeks at about $50,000 per patient.
And then they go back to the Haiti and they're self-sufficient, or they need regular medical care?
Well, that's a good question. We see it as two groups. Those with simple fractures who get casted will probably be able to go back to Haiti and just need crutches. And then there's a second group that had gangrene, which often led to amputations, and some of them have developed renal failure secondary to their gangrene. This is going to be difficult to get them back to Haiti. They need ongoing rehab. They need prosthesis. They'll probably suffer post-traumatic stress disorder. So that group's not going to be able to get back to Haiti easily.
And it's not going to be cheap either. Dr. McKenney, please stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
The president's budget was announced yesterday. It's a $4 trillion budget, contains $300 billion for recession relief and job stimulus this year. It puts narrowing the deficit on hold until the economy rebounds. But the New York Times estimates that American deficits will not return to what are considered sustainable levels for at least a decade. The answer to Toyota's recall problems is a small steel shim. It's the size of a postage stamp, and it's going to start arriving at Toyota dealerships across the country today. The process of fixing defective accelerator pedals that's going to cost the company at least $1 billion. And cue up the Pennsylvania polka. It's Groundhog's Day, folks. Next hour, Punxsutawney Phil, the weather forecasting groundhog, will emerge to check for his shadow.
Looking at the markets, futures are up. The Dow will start at 10,185, the S&P at 1,089, and the NASDAQ at 2,171. Coming up, we're asking you, if you have an unemployed friend, what's the best way that you know to help them out? Look over their resume, maybe give them some money. We're going to talk about that every Tuesday and as we do work, and we're going to talk about that issue later this hour. survivors of the Haitian earthquake are still being airlifted right now to Florida hospitals, hopefully to hospitals in other states as well. And they're being treated in American hospitals, and those American hospitals right now are shouldering those costs. But the question is, who will shoulder the burden of the cost of treatment now and in the future? Joining us now again is Dr. Mark McKenney. He's the chief of surgery at the University of Miami Hospital. And Dr. Aneta Roldan is the president and CEO of Jackson Health System. It's the only public health care system in Miami. Dr. Roldan, you heard Dr. McKenney talking about the fact that they estimate it costs $50,000 per patient for the treatment of injuries sustained during the earthquake. Who's paying for that right now?
Good morning, Celeste. Well, right now we have basically two groups. We have the first group were basically U.S. Haitian U.S. citizens, and many of them, a good 90% of them, were covered by insurance. That cost to date is approximately $2.2 million in charges. Those will be sent to a third-party payer. Then you've got the second group, which mostly came in subsequent flights, of of Haitian nationals, and those charges up to date is approximately $2.3 million. As of yesterday, we did receive notice that through the NDMS, we will probably be able to have some reimbursement at approximately 110% of Medicare rates for those patients that do not have any other coverage. But before yesterday, we did not have any confirmation. We were able to be in touch and communicate almost on a daily basis with both state and federal agencies, as well as our state senators and Congress. But as of yesterday, we did not have any other confirmation.
So up until today, you said it's cost somewhere above $2 million. Will that get reimbursed by the federal government through this program that you're talking about that they announced yesterday?
Well, we don't know if this is going to be retroactive. One of the things that we are doing from day one is being able to track the cost of the patients, but we don't know if this is going to be retroactive. We know that this is as of yesterday, so it is moving forward. I will continue, though, to work with both our state and our federal agencies to see how we can get reimbursed for the charges that already have been at cost to the system.
And Dr. McKenney, you actually traveled to Haiti and recently returned from there. How many patients have been airlifted out of Haiti to American hospitals?
Total of about 500, of which 350 have gone to Florida and about 150 have gone to the Ryder Trauma Center at Jackson Memorial Hospital. So we're overwhelmingly getting the majority of the patients in the state, and our hospital alone have taken more patients than the rest of the country.
And are you still able to accommodate the American patients that you have?
Absolutely. Our mission requires that we treat the Americans first, but we've all been working overtime, extra shifts, volunteering our time in order to be able to take care of both groups. It's quite a strain.
And have you sent any of these patients back to Haiti?
No, as of right now, we haven't. Some of the more modest injuries, though, could start to be sent back soon.
Dr. Aneta Roldan of the Jackson Health System, how many patients have come into your health system from Haiti?
Approximately as of Saturday, Jackson Health System has treated 137 patients who were injured during the earthquake. And of those, 98 have already been discharged. And the majority have been treated at Jackson, Maine. As you know, Jackson Health System is a system of six hospitals, which includes our children's hospital. At the children's hospital, about 42 children have been treated at the Children's Hospital, and 35 of them have been discharged as of current.
They suspended airlifts for several days because Florida hospitals said they were being overwhelmed. Are your hospitals overwhelmed?
No, one of the things that we are doing on a daily basis, we watch very closely our bed capacity as well as our resources, which include our own staff. Because we are spread throughout three campuses, what we have done is use the resources across the health system, and only the patients that really need that have catastrophic injuries and need the trauma center will stay at Jackson, Maine, which have been a good majority of them. But we've also used our resources at Jackson North and Jackson South, which are multi-specialty community hospitals.
Dr. McKenney, as a trauma surgeon, You know, you sort of raise the issue that when you send people back to Haiti with some of these injuries that are going to require perhaps even lifelong rehab, how do you evaluate the release date of some of these patients when you know, unlike releasing them into the South Florida area, that they're not going to have rehab opportunities and maybe you're going to have to keep them longer?
Which is exactly what's happening, both here in Miami, and we have a tent hospital set up in Haiti, and the same things are happening. We're trying to make decisions based on not what would normally happen, but what's going to happen to this special group because the care and the long-term follow-up is unclear.
And, you know, a lot of people have been telling us this week, what does Haiti need that's going to help it long-term? It sounds like there should be investments on those kinds of long-term chronic care sorts of facilities in Haiti as much as they need the trauma relief and the $50,000 per bed cost that you're paying.
Yeah, they need food, shelter, and they need a functioning hospital, hopefully which we can switch over and be staffed by Haitians. We've actually taken over one of the other hospitals in Haiti because all the Haitian surgeons were killed in the earthquake. So unlike we've been to all the disasters, Katrina, New Orleans, Oklahoma, New York, Quito, Turkey, and unlike all the others, what happened is they needed a helping hand. They got on their feet in a couple of weeks, and then we transitioned the care to the local country personnel. In Haiti, that's not happening. Many of the surgeons and nurses were killed. The hospitals are not functioning normally, and it's a difficult transition.
So in these other cases where you've dealt with survivors of disasters, how long was that transition?
Usually 2 weeks.
And certainly in this case, it could be a matter of months.
Yeah, it's already been going on 4 weeks. We don't have a clear mechanism to transfer all the care over to the Haitian community in Haiti.
Well, right. The takeaway is he's saying it's not happening at all. That's really disturbing, Dr. McKinney.
Yeah, the opposite is actually happening now. The Haitians are starting to identify us as the caregivers and are starting to send over more patients. Oh. So the exit strategy is not clear. We're on the ground right now, but we need to help set up Haitians who can take care of the Haitian people.
That is Dr. Mark McKinney, Medical Director at Ryder Trauma Center and the Chief of Surgery at the University of Miami Hospital. We also spoke with Dr. Anita Roldan, President and CEO of Jackson Health System. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in now on the headlines.
Toyota says it will take about an hour to repair your vehicle if it's one of the recalled vehicles to fix those defective accelerator pedals. Here's Toyota President Jim Lentz.
The parts will be arriving in dealerships. If not late on Tuesday, they will begin arriving on Wednesday. All of the training should be completed by the end of the week, so they will start working on consumer vehicles this weekend.
The fix is a small slip of metal the size of a postage stamp. President Obama is urging Congress to approve his nearly $4 trillion budget plan. His proposal calls for a record $1.6 trillion deficit. The president says he'll pull back on spending next year, but he says in the current economic situation, stimulus spending is necessary.
We're at war. Our economy's lost 7 million jobs over the last 2 years, and our government is deeply in debt after what can only be described as a decade of profligacy.
The budget includes nearly $300 billion for recession relief and job creation.
In healthcare, lawmakers in 34 states are moving ahead with constitutional amendments to ban government health insurance requirements. They say penalties against people who refuse to carry health insurance is a violation of individual rights. And more in a story we told you about yesterday. In Kettleman City, California, health officials say a sixth birth defect has been confirmed. That's the same town where residents are fighting the expansion of the state's largest hazardous waste landfill. The state has opened an investigation. It's a look at some of the stories you're following this morning. We're going to be talking about Super Bowl ads in just a few minutes, but we're also asking you, how do you help a friend who is unemployed? If you're unemployed, what's the one thing you'd want your friends to do? And if you know someone who's out of work, what can you do? Give us your story at 8778-MY-TAKE.
Hey, you want that to go?
It's that time for some news takeouts on stories you're following. The economy and politics never truly fall far apart. That's true today. In his State of the Union address, President Obama said his administration has lost its connection with the American public. And he's trying to reestablish that connection with his second town hall in 6 days. The president is on his way to New Hampshire today. Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, is he going to be talking about money?
Oh, money, money, money. And the subtext will be politics. Good morning, Celeste. The president goes up to Nashua, New Hampshire to tout his budget and also his job creation plans. One of the things that we know he's going to announce is a plan to take $30 billion from the bank bailout, the TARP program, and hand that over to small and community banks with the understanding that they will lend to small businesses. This is part of getting small businesses sparked and creating jobs. Of course, you can imagine that Democrats on the Hill love the idea of taking some of that big bank bailout money and giving it to the little guy, as it were. But Republicans, starting to hear the word slush fund thrown around on Capitol Hill, Celeste. They're starting to say, hey, if this TARP money is being paid back, let's start to pay down the deficit, not use it as the White House's slush fund to move the money elsewhere. So that's the reaction on the Hill for that.
Surely it's a coincidence that the president is traveling to New Hampshire, a state that happens to be so important in primaries.
Yes, the swing state of New Hampshire. Surely that's a coincidence. You know, if Massachusetts was sort of independent voter anger satellite in this special election we just saw for the Senate, you know, New Hampshire is really angry voter central, angry independent voter central. It's no accident. It's a major swing state, and there's a Senate race. There's a Senate seat that's up in 2010 that is an absolute toss-up. Nobody knows which way it's going to go, so that's exactly where the president's going to tout his job creation.
Thanks, Todd. Todd Zwillick is the Takeaway Washington correspondent.
Our next takeout considers the plight of Toyota. Their recall is supposedly going to cost them about $1 billion. That's pocket change for Toyota. And the fix for the accelerator pedals is about an hour and takes a little sliver of metal inserted behind the accelerator to actually fix. But what is the cost to the brand? Cindy Gallup joins us once again, former chairman of the ad agency BBH. She's a active advertising consultant these days. Good morning, Cindy.
Hi, good morning.
You know, we talked to a dealer yesterday, Cindy, who actually was a little bit candid about how Toyota owners were scratching their heads a little bit coming in, not really used to this kind of quality control problem with the Toyota. What do you think the long-term cost is here?
Well, it's interesting, John, because Toyota is in a very, very serious situation here indeed. The fact that people have died using your product because of a product defect is, obviously, the seriousness cannot be overstated.
Right.
Interestingly, Toyota does have an opportunity here to recover itself on two fronts. The first is that studies have proven that when people are disappointed in a brand or a company, and that disappointment is addressed very radically in the right kind of way, then actually their opinion of the brand or the company going forward can be higher than if there had been no problem at all.
So that's an opportunity. Bringing all these people in, it's a chance to get face time with their customers. They can really do something here.
Absolutely. And the second thing I was going to say was, interesting, it's an opportunity at a time when there's a huge amount of soul-searching going on within Toyota, obviously, but there's also soul-searching going on within all the other automotive brands. And what we're not seeing is very dramatic differences of behavior on the part of the competition at a time of difficulty for everybody. So right now, it's absolutely about what Toyota does to address this. And if the soul-searching going on results in a very, very radical rethink of how the company operates and what it does, then that can still be an opportunity for them to regain people's confidence and trust.
We'll talk to you again if they actually come out with an ad campaign touting how well they handled the recall. We'll just have to see.
Okay, that would be a bad idea. This isn't about what Toyota said, it's about what Toyota does.
That's why we call on Cindy Gallup, advertising consultant, former chairman of the ad agency BBH. Thanks, Cindy.
And now on to sports and money. The place where sports and money intersect is the Super Bowl. Super Bowl ads cost millions of dollars. And in the past, it's always been really creative ads for Bud Light and Doritos and restaurants. But this year, something different. Louise Story's with us. She's from our partner, the New York Times. Louise, how much does a commercial cost this year?
Well, this year, you don't know for sure. They don't tell us. But this year, people are estimating that the Super Bowl ads are going for $2.4 million to $2.8 million. That would not be a record. After all, our economy's kind of down. The record's more like $3 million. But it's a lot of money. And the reason advertisers pay this much money on the Super Bowl is because it is the only event in the year where people actually glue themselves to their seats in the commercial breaks and say, I want to see these ads. I'm not fast-forwarding. I'm not going to the bathroom. And so it's really the biggest advertising event of the year. And this year, We're expecting to see ads from Coca-Cola, Taco Bell, Budweiser, and an unusual ad, which is anti-abortion.
Right. And in the past, other people have wanted to put political messages on, and the Super Bowl has always said, no, we refuse all of them. That's our policy, and that's kind of how they've tamped down controversy.
Right. So the networks have had policies against advocacy ads, and CBS is the network that has the Super Bowl this year. You know, it alternates between three networks. And they're allowing advocacy ads, and they're allowing one from a group called Focus on the Family, which is
James Dobson.
Right, an anti-abortion group, and they have a commercial they'll be showing that is expected to feature Tim Tebow, you know, the college football player, and his mother. And, you know, his mom has talked in the past about how she's glad she didn't have an abortion, even though some doctors had recommended it for her, because, look, she got this son, Tim, who is a great person, a great football player. So we don't know what the commercial will say, but it's unlikely to be the kind of funny, lighthearted ad, and it might spur a lot of debate.
Might spur a lot of... I would imagine that it would, especially considering the fact that they declined to air an ad from a gay dating online dating service. Thanks. That's Louise Story. She's the Takeaway Finance contributor. Coming up, the president wants to completely overhaul the No Child Left Behind Act.
Instead of rewarding failure, we only reward success.
What does that mean for educators? What is success in the classroom? We're going to talk about that in a few minutes.
Coming up, we leave no educational policy initiative behind here on The Takeaway. We're going to talk about the president's plan to change the No Child Left Behind Act in just a few moments. But right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. The president's budget may face an early test this week on Capitol Hill. The proposed tax credit for small businesses could come up for a vote in the Senate by Friday. In the meantime, the president is urging Congress to pass his budget, even though that means raising the federal deficit to $1.6 trillion.
It's time to save what we can, spend what we must, and live within our means once again.
The president will be in New Hampshire to promote his idea to funnel $30 billion to community banks so they can help small businesses. Defense Secretary Robert Gates is going to announce today a year-long review of the impact of lifting the ban on gays serving openly in the military. That lifting of the ban was announced by the president in his State of the Union address.
The U.S. military now says it will fly injured Haitian earthquake survivors to several states to avoid overloading Florida. David Hansel of Health and Human Services says the state has treated an overwhelming majority of the victims so far.
More than 20,000 U.S. citizens have been repatriated from Haiti to the U.S., and of these, 19,440 have come to the state of Florida.
The government will also reimburse hospitals who treat earthquake victims. In Washington, the American Red Cross says a waiting list of 1,000 flights for Haiti's airport is limiting delivery of supplies. Meanwhile, Haitian officials are considering a trial for the 10 Americans arrested while trying to take children out of the country without proper documents. The Haitian prime minister says the Americans knew they were breaking the law, especially since some of the children have surviving parents. And the answer to Toyota's recall problems is a small steel shim. It's about the size of a postage stamp. Those parts will start arriving at Toyota dealerships across the country today, and the process of adding them to recalled cars and trucks should begin by the weekend. Toyota President Jim Lentz says the fix will solve the problem.
We are very confident that this will stop the issues of acceleration caused by entrapment of a pedal.
There are reports that say the recall's cost is at least $1 billion up front. Taking a check on the markets, Asian and European markets are up, and futures as well. The Dow will start at 10,185. The S&P opens at 1,089, and the NASDAQ at 2,171. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
So you may recall, early in this decade, one of the very early successes of the George W. Bush administration was passing the No Child Left Behind Act. It was a bipartisan legislative initiative that brought accountability into school systems using testing and the elimination of so-called failing schools. Well, the president, Barack Obama, in his State of the Union address, his first State of the Union address, early in his administration, announced these possible strategic changes in No Child Left Behind.
Instead of rewarding failure, we only reward success. Instead of funding the status quo, we only invest in reform. Reform that raises student achievement, inspires students to excel in math and science, and turns around failing schools that steal the future of too many young Americans from rural communities to the inner city. In the 21st century, the best anti-poverty program around is a world-class education.
Well, what do those passionately talked about ideas from the president mean in the schoolhouse? Joining us now is Dan Domenech, who's executive director of the American Association of School Administrators. He joins us from Virginia. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
And Dr. Virginia Minshew is a principal at Parkview High School in Sterling, Virginia. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, you know, let's talk a little bit about what seems to be a shift in emphasis. No Child Left Behind was all about accountability and the elimination of so-called failed schools. It seems like the president wants to substitute more of a reward-based system. How do you see that, Dan Domenech?
Well, we are very excited about that change because, frankly, there were good things and bad things about No Child Left Behind. But one of the things that I really rankled educators and many parents was the very punitive elements of No Child Left Behind, where by virtue of the way that they computed things like adequate yearly progress, there were many sound, good-performing schools around the country that were labeled as failures, and many students that were labeled as failing, when really a reward, a more positive aspect to the program, as the president now suggests, I think would have done more to further the cause of closing that achievement gap.
Now, again, we don't know the specifics, but is it your understanding that the federal government would then assist schools that are having trouble measuring up to turn them around, as the president suggested in his speech?
Absolutely. We've had the opportunity to meet on a regular basis with Secretary of Education Duncan and his staff, and they're definitely focusing on what they've identified as the lowest 5%. Including about 2,000 high schools around the country that are referred to as dropout factories. And they're going to be putting a great deal of focus and attention on those schools and providing the kind of financial support that they will need, hopefully, to transform themselves.
So, Virginia Minshew, what does that mean for your students, and when can you expect maybe the cavalry to arrive there from the federal government?
Well, I agree with what Dr. Domenech said in terms of this rewards success for and positive things going on in school. I like the concept that this is rewarding growth in schools and in classrooms. There are many of us who work in school-based programs who see our teachers and our kids working extremely hard and making progress, but because on that one test day, they didn't do well on the test, all of their efforts are really devalued. And I think that what has been proposed certainly looks at a wider breadth of experiences for students and for teachers, because we do want to be held accountable.
Dr. Minshew, is there a value to continuity here? It took many years for schools to gear up to actually implement a No Child Left Behind. Is a full-scale change going to be disruptive to the classroom there in Sterling, Virginia?
You know, when I read the brief information that I have read, it's really not a total full-scale change. It's really a tweaking of some of the things that we feel as educators need to be changed. That focus on that one-time test, looking, and I can use my school as an example. We are a school who has really grown in the last 3 years, but yet this last year, I am classified as a school that did not make AYP because in two subgroups, my pass rate was 78% rather than 79%.
So it's a different way of using the data, staying with the test, more of a tweak, but something that accounts for the changing situation in your community. Dan Domenech, we've already heard about the president's program called Race to the Top, which attempts to identify best practices and reward them with cash. Do you think that figures into this program at all?
Well, I think it does. I think what we've seen the administration doing is kind of signaling their intent for the reauthorization of what we refer to now as No Child Left Behind. We saw that with the stimulus dollars that went out. We're seeing it now with the guidelines for Race to the Top. We're seeing it in the guidelines for the innovation funds that are going to become available this spring. So there's no question that the administration has been telegraphing the direction they want to take, and it very much is the carrot, more of the carrot than the stick approach.
Right.
Well, that they're dangling dollars at a time when schools desperately need every cent they can get. I mean, you can just read here in the Washington, D.C. area, Montgomery County, Fairfax County, all the districts that are really cutting their budgets to pieces because of the lack of funding. So school systems and states are hungry for dollars, and they are jumping through hoops to qualify to get these dollars.
But there's much more federal influence in education if you count No Child Left Behind, plus these new initiatives from the Obama administration. The federal government is definitely stepping into education. Dr. Virginia Minshew is a principal at Parkview High School in Sterling, Virginia. Dan Domenech, executive director of the American Association of School Administrators. Coming up, how do you help your friends who are unemployed? That's our conversation on The Takeaway. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. First off, a warning. There are some spoilers for some great shows ahead.
Great shows?
Tonight marks the beginning of the end of an, oh my God, so totally confusing but still strangely compelling journey. For those who've stuck with the show for the last 5 years, it's the last season of Lost.
This is what you've been wasting your time on?
Dudes, listen. Our lives suck. Everyone's nerves are stretched to the max. I mean, we're lost on an island, running from boars and monsters, freaking polar bears.
Polar bears?
You didn't hear about the polar bear?
A few years ago, it was announced that Lost would have this definite end date, and one of our staffers said, yay!
Many of our staff said yay.
It's true, because look at it this way. Good TV is best enjoyed like a lovely dinner, just enough to leave you wanting more, not an all-you-can-eat buffet.
There are a lot of shows that could learn from having an expiration date. There's an actual word for this, TV executives. You actually came up with it on Happy Days. Remember the Jump the Shark episode?
We both make one jump. There's only one condition. We jump an obstacle.
Well, let's make it something big, you know, like your head.
Good one. Oh, it's big all right. It's the shark.
So Happy Days jumped the shark, but let's take case one, The Office. The American Office continues on and on with its sixth season. But, you know, I think they can learn a lesson from the predecessor show, Over the Pond, The British Office.
The people you work with are people you were just thrown together with, and yet you spend more time with them than you do your friends or your family. And so when someone comes in who you have a connection with, and Dawn was a ray of sunshine in my life, but if I'm really being honest, I never really thought it would have a happy ending.
Of course, the guy does get the girl, but do you know how quickly it took the show to get from beginning to end? Just 13 episodes.
13?
That's it.
Isn't that kind of an unlucky
13
number?
Classics. Instant classics. That's the way the Brits do things. Short and sweet.
You know what?
Like
you got to know when to quit while you're ahead. There's some shows that had the chance to end early and wrap things up, but they kept going. Case number two, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. That show was on for 7 years, but get this, at the end of its fifth year, the network was dropping, and that was good timing because the show had planned a big finale. Buffy saved her sister's life by sacrificing her own.
Don, listen to me. Listen. I love you. I will always love you. But this is the work that I have to do.
Doesn't that sound like the end of a really good, strong ending? That's where the series was supposed to stop. No Buffy, no Buffy the Vampire Slayer. But then what happens? The show got picked up by another network. They had to resurrect Buffy.
Well, it is about vampires. I mean, they can do anything they want.
Well, yeah, but, you know, according to our producer, Leo, the quality of the show just went straight down the tubes.
Poor, poor Buffy. But there are some shows that can be a model of knowing when to end it, although we had a little debate around The Office here. Ones that stay on the air for just long enough, like The Wire.
When you walk through the garden.
The creators set the show up like a Greek tragedy or a Shakespeare play with a story arc that only spanned 5 seasons. That way, when the last few episodes aired, there were no loose ends to tie up.
Either we fix this police department and the crime goes down, or we don't, and the crime stays up.
Commissioner, we're talking about a little help. In the next couple quarters, that's all.
No. What the? Tell the mayor his debts will be clean.
5 seasons, 5 acts. You can't improve on Shakespeare. So TV executives, I know it's hard to let go of the cash cows, but you can't risk the quality. I mean, 24, that show's got to go. American Idol, get rid of it. It's done. Over.
Expiration dates, they're great for milk. Why can't you use them for TV shows, please? And listeners, if you have a show that you think needs to go, that has reached its expiration date, let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. You know, John, Americans are generous people. They like to help. And what we're talking about today when we talk about work is how do you help those of you, the people that you know that are unemployed? How do you help a friend who's unemployed? Do you give them money? Do you offer them a job somewhere? And if you are unemployed, what do you need the most? That's how we're starting this conversation. Let us know your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We're going to talk about it more in just a few minutes. First, let's take a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. The U.S. military will begin flying critically ill survivors of the Haitian earthquake to several states in an effort to avoid overloading Florida hospitals. In the wake of that decision, Florida Governor Charlie Crist wants to set the record straight.
Florida never said that we wanted to stop taking Haitians. All we said was that we would appreciate help in being able to continue to help our friends from the island. And that's exactly what has happened.
The federal government will also now reimburse American hospitals who treat earthquake victims. Meanwhile, 10 Americans arrested while trying to take children out of Haiti without proper documents may be heading for trial. The Haitian prime minister says the Americans knew they were breaking the law, and some of the children have surviving parents. But no charges have yet been filed.
Postage-sized piece of metal is the fix for vehicles affected in Toyota's worldwide recall. Toyota Vice President Robert Waltz says it's not a temporary repair.
It's a long-term fix. It is not an interim solution to a problem.
And it costs the company about $1 billion. That's what the estimate is. And the fix will take less than an hour per vehicle. China is threatening to impose sanctions on American companies involved with controversial arms trade to Taiwan. Joining us to talk about the significance of this, and there's political and economic significance to it, BBC China editor Xiong Chen joins us from London. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's talk a little bit about, this constantly happens when there's an arms sale to Taiwan and the Chinese threaten something. But what are the limits of the threat and the nature of the threat as you understand it this morning, Xiong Chen?
Well, this time, the threat against those supplies to Taiwan, this arms deal, looks kind of real. Before this time, when the Chinese felt angry about any arms sale to Taiwan, they would threaten to cut off dialogue and break up any exchange. But to specifically say they're going to aim to sanction some U.S. Companies involved, that is a first strong signal. Having said that, it's going to be complicated in this sanction business. In fact, some Chinese business leaders and politicians are debating to sanction or not to sanction.
And indeed, China has a lot of leverage. It buys aircraft from Boeing, which is one of the companies that's on the potential sanction list. And China supplies high-tech parts to a lot of weapons suppliers, so they're in a position to actually shut down supply lines. So, Xiong Chen, thanks so much for joining us. Xiong Chen is the BBC China editor who joined us from London. So, in other news, Super Bowl week. Louisiana's attorney general says shops can sell T-shirts with the phrase, "Who dat?" Okay, it's a free country.
That was a question?
But they can't reference the New Orleans Saints or the NFL. No, that's a trade violation. The NFL tried to block the sales because it was part of a popular cheer by Saints fans. And staying with the big gang, CBS has sold out of ads for the Super Bowl. Average price for a 30-second commercial tops $3 million. Too late to get your, garage sale ad there in the Super Bowl
list. Yeah, I was hoping to buy a couple ads.
Some of the stories we're following.
We talk about work on The Takeaway on Tuesdays, and today we're talking about how to help people who are unemployed. Here's the statistical fact. There are so many people in the United States who are unemployed that even if you yourself are not unemployed, it's extremely likely that somebody close to you is. And the question today is, how do you help? Or if you're unemployed, what help do you need? Joining us to talk about this is Justin Jones-Fosu, a leadership trainer and host of WEAA Baltimore's Listen Up. He's got some advice on this subject. And also Elena Guevara is a technical fashion designer, been out of work for the past 10 months, Elena?
Yes.
Okay, and she's going to talk about what friends have been trying to do to help her. So most of the past 9 or 10 months, you've been unemployed. That's a long time.
Yes, it is a long time.
I assume that your friends want to help you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what is okay and what's not okay? I have friends that I would like to help. What can I do for them? Is it just resume service? Can I offer to pay to copy or mail their resume? Can I offer them money?
I if you know, friends get weird about money, so I don't know if that is specifically the right way to go, unless it's specifically asked for. But, you know, in the beginning when I was actively looking for work, I did have friends print out copies of my resume for me at their jobs because I don't have access to a printer at home. And that was very helpful. That was useful. I've also had the dinner invitations and, you know, friends took me out for drinks and took me out for dinner. And, you know, that's always very nice.
Okay. So were they helpful?
Yeah, I would say those things are helpful. I mean, the last thing you want to do is become isolated when you're unemployed. And I mean, you're already spending all day at home by yourself anyway. So if you see your friends less often because you can't afford to go out, you know, that just adds to that feeling of isolation.
Okay, Justin, we have 10% of Americans unemployed. Everybody knows that somebody that's out of work. How can we help someone that we know that is unemployed?
A very good question. I think, first of all, being available and listening is so important. We really can't underestimate that. Almost half of unemployed people surveyed by the New York Times in December said they suffered from depression or anxiety, and having someone to talk to can really help. But it's also really appreciated when you try to help them get connected to some job opportunities. Talk them up, even when they're not around, to some of your business contacts, the networking events, and, you know, just some of the places outside of your fields of work. The more people you know, the larger potential of them hearing about job leads.
Okay, but some of my good friends, I can think of a couple of them right now. I'm either not sure what they're like on the job, or I happen to know one who is chronic absences. I mean, am I taking a risk by talking somebody up that I'm not sure of their job performance?
You make a really good point, Celeste. You know, one thing we can't do is jeopardize our own reputation and credibility for the sake of your friends. Only recommend people that you have a lot of confidence in, and you can connect those to your main contacts. For the rest of some of your unemployed friends, offer to help sell themselves, connect them to some networking sites, whether LinkedIn or Facebook, because it's interesting that more than two-thirds consider their changing their career field, and you can help brainstorm with them to help them find, you know, a potential job.
Maybe get with a little imagination. So, Elena Guevara, have you had offers of help that was, I mean, you talked about people taking you out to dinner or copying your resume for you. What if people offered that was not so helpful?
More general job search ideas, like suggestions like, have you tried Craigslist or have you networked with your friends? I mean, very general things like that. I mean, either they don't apply to me or I've already tried them. Yeah.
Have you thought about getting a job at all?
Yeah, I have a friend who keeps pushing me into waitressing work, and I'm like, I have never waitressed in my life. Why do you think that I would be qualified to waitress until I find a regular job? Like, I just assume that, you know, a restaurant is going to hire people with experience rather than someone who just happens to be an unemployed fashion designer who needs to waitress.
But there's an awkwardness around this. You know, I mean, one of my friends wanted to go to a training session that would help her in her job search. She said, I'm not sure if I can afford the plane ticket. I said, let me buy the plane ticket for you. I mean, is that okay? Is that if somebody offered that to you, is that an okay thing to offer?
Yeah, I think that would be an okay thing to offer. Absolutely.
Do you feel awkward sometimes? Have there been offers of help that you felt strange about accepting?
There, I mean, on a small level, yes. I don't want to have my friends take me out to dinner all the time. So after a while, I kind of stopped accepting invitations out.
You should hit her up for a plane ticket. I think that'd be a good idea.
Well, Justin, what about this awkward? I mean, she's saying that she, after a while, she stops accepting it, but at the same time, she doesn't want to be isolated.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things we should definitely do is consider giving them money, but not as a charity for work that they do. One great couple of websites that you can use is, if you decide to give them money, is give them anonymously. There's an organization that's called givinganon.org or myregistry.com, which you can leave money for them as an anonymous tip.
Well, I mean, are there other things? Are there things that people should not do, that people should steer away from offering?
Absolutely. I think that you have to be very careful in communicating yourself like you're giving them charity. So you have to take a step back and realize, what kind of friend is this? How would they respond to this? And if you can give them money as a gift or ask them to pay it forward, but don't make them feel pressured that they have to pay it back.
Okay. Justin Jones-Fosu is a leadership trainer and host of WEAA Baltimore's Listen Up. Elena Guevara, unemployed technical fashion designer who you should accept those free dinners. Thanks to both of you.
If you're unemployed right now, what's the one thing you'd want your friends to do? Tell us a story of something that you've done to help a friend out. Tell us at 877-
disseminate my take, or you can post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. And every day we write up a sneak peek at the stories we're working on for tomorrow's show. You can read along as the news develops by following our blog. Stop by thetakeaway.org and click on blog. The Super Bowl is next weekend. You're probably not going, but is your congressman? ProPublica and The Takeaway are teaming up to find out which politicians are going to the big game and how they got their tickets. Go to the website to find out. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.